Our passage this evening comes from 1 Samuel chapter 25. 1 Samuel chapter 25. Now, this is a rather long, extended narrative, but I think we will read most of it. We'll read through about verse 39 to get it in front of us and refresh our minds about it again. 1 Samuel 25, beginning at verse 1. Now Samuel had died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him at his home in Ramah. Then David rose up and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon, and his operations were in Carmel. And the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The man's name was Nabal, his wife's name Abigail. And the woman had good sense and a beautiful figure, but the man was harsh and nasty in behavior, and he was a Calebite. Now David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young fellows, and David said to the fellows, "Go up to Carmel, and you shall go to Nabal and ask him in my name about his welfare. And this is what you shall say: to life, may you prosper, as well as your house and all that you have. And now I hear you have sheep shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did not harm them, nor did they find anything missing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men and let them tell you, and may my young fellows find grace in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you can to your servants and to your son David." So David's young men came and spoke in David's name to Nabal in line with these words. Then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? All sorts of servants are breaking away, each from his master nowadays. And I should take my bread and my water and the meat I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men, ones I don't know where they're from?" So David's men turned around on their journey and returned and came and told him all these things. Then David said to his men, "Each man buckle on his sword." So each man buckled on his sword, and David buckled on his sword as well. So about 400 men went up after David, and 200 stayed with the equipment. Now a certain servant from the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he screamed at them. But the men were very good to us. We suffered no harm, and we had nothing missing all the time we were around with them while we were in the open country. They were a wall around us, both by night and by day, all the days we were with them shepherding the flock. And now, know and see what you must do, for disaster has been determined for our master and against all his household. And he's such a wicked scoundrel that one cannot talk to him." So Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep ready dressed, 5 measures of parched grain, 100 bunches of raisins, and 200 fig cakes, and placed them on donkeys. Then she said to her young men, "Go on before me. See, I'm coming after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Now she was riding on the donkey and going down in the cover of the hill, and indeed David and his men were coming down to meet her, and she ran into them. Now David had said, "Surely for nothing I've kept all that belongs to this fellow in the wilderness, and nothing that belonged to him was missing, and he has paid me back evil for good. May God do to the enemies of David and add all the more if I leave until morning a single male of all that belongs to him." When Abigail saw David, she hurriedly got down from the donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed down to the ground. So she fell at his feet and said, "The guilt is all mine, my lord, and please let your handmaid speak in your ears and hear the words of your handmaid. Don't let my lord set his heart on this wicked scoundrel, on Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your handmaid, I did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. And now, my lord, by the life of Yahweh and by your own life, Yahweh has held you back from coming with bloodshed and from your own hand gaining victory for you. And now may your enemies and those seeking harm to my lord be as Nabal." And now this blessing which your servant girl has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who wander around at the feet of my Lord. Please forgive the transgression of your handmaid, for Yahweh will surely make for my Lord a sure house. For my Lord is fighting the battles of Yahweh, and no evil will be found in you through your days. And when anyone rises up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound up in the bundle of life with Yahweh your God. But the life of your enemies he will sling away from the hollow of a sling. And it shall be when Yahweh will do for my Lord in line with all the benefit he has promised you, and he has appointed you as leader over Israel, this will not prove something that makes you stagger or gives remorse of conscience to my Lord, that is, by shedding blood needlessly, or by my Lord's getting victory for himself. And when Yahweh shall prosper my Lord, remember your handmaid. Then David said to Abigail, blessed be Yahweh, the God of Israel, who has sent you this very day to meet me, and blessed be your judgment, and blessed be you yourself who have restrained me this day from coming with bloodshed and letting my own hand get victory for me. But as surely as Yahweh, God of Israel, lives, who has held me back from harming you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, there would not have been left to Nabal a single male by morning light. So David took from her what she had brought to him, and to her he said, go up in peace to your house. See, I have listened to your voice and accepted you. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and why he was holding a drinking feast in his house like the feast of a king. And the heart of Nabal was happy. He was very drunk. And she did not say a single word to him until morning light. When morning came, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him all these things, and his heart died within him, and he became like stone. Then it happened in about 10 days, Yahweh struck Nabal, and he died. Now David heard that Nabal had died, and he said, blessed be Yahweh who has prosecuted the case of the insults I received from the hand of Nabal, and who restrained his servant from evil. And Yahweh has returned the evil of Nabal upon his own head. Then David sent and spoke with Abigail to take her as his wife. Now we'll stop our reading of God's written word at that point. You may have people in your family or in your acquaintance, and you wonder how they ever got together. I had a great aunt. She was named Aunt Eva. And she eventually married a fellow by the name of Ralph Wallace, and we called him Uncle Ralph, and so on. They were in their 50s, I think, when they finally married. Now, Aunt Eva was smart. She was educated. She was crabby. She was dirty. In her kitchen, they would eat breakfast and so on. And when you go visit them, you would find that after breakfast, you pull a plastic tablecloth over, you know, dishes that had had eggs and bacon, all sorts of junk on it. Just pull a plastic tablecloth over it and let it set. And then you take that off when you come to the next meal, and there your plates are to eat again. As I say, she was dirty, and she was lazy. Uncle Ralph, on the other hand, was the height of graciousness. He was congenial and so on. And fortunately for him, he died. Aunt Eva lived on until she was 99 to radiate joy and happiness to other people for a long time. But you look back at that, and if you're not right in the thick of it, you say, how on earth did they ever get together? What would possess a man to do that kind of thing? And you might wonder about that deep in the territory of Judah in the south of Israel. We don't know how Nabal and Abigail got together and married and what led them to do that. Situations, obviously, a bit different, I suppose, than in our Western situation. But how did they marry? I mean, why? What would bring them together? But there they are. They're married. Maybe Nabal wasn't always like this. We don't know. But Nabal was a rich herdsman, and he was a scoundrel. And Abigail was insightful and beautiful. You get all that in the setting in verses 1 to 3. And as it turns out, this beautiful woman makes a big difference. Now, let's just rehearse the story a bit and see the pattern of it. We won't take too long with this, but it's a well-put-together narrative. And if you want to put it together, you can do it in three movements. The first movement is tension. That has to do with the stupidity of Nabal. That's in verses 4 to 17. And you notice that's the part where David sends to Nabal, sends his men, and they want a, well, they want a gratuity. David's men had served as protectors of Nabal's herdsmen, keeping foreign tribes, perhaps, from ravaging their flocks or anyone else, raiders from robbing the flock and so on. And so they had done this, and now it would be nice to have a little gratuity from, David had 600 men and their dependents that he had to try to supply and nourish and care for with food and provisions and so on. So this was a pretty urgent matter, and he asked for a gratuity. And of course, in verses 12 and 13, Nabal's reaction was violent and vicious and nasty and so on. So, typical, his name is Nabal, as Abigail indicates later. It means fool. The idea of fool there is not so much stupidity, but godlessness, a godless sort of person, a wicked scoundrel, and so on. And of course, there are some scholars that say they just can't believe Nabal's parents would name him that. There is another root spelled the same way that could mean something like noble, and they think maybe that was the parents' intent, sort of like, I don't know, what you say, homonyms or something like that, the words that sound the same but have different meanings, like peace meaning tranquility in relationships, and peace meaning piece of pie, but it's pronounced the same way and so on. Well, Nabal might have been noble in the view of his parents, but Abigail's had experience, and she says Nabal is Nabal the other word for fool. So he answers David in this wicked, nasty way. So tension, the stupidity of Nabal, verses 4 to 17. Then the next movement is intervention. And that's the wisdom of Abigail. That's verses 18 to 35. In the middle of this section, in verses 24 through 31, or 23 through 31, you have Abigail's speech to David. And that speech is, I understand, the longest speech by a woman in the Old Testament. That makes any difference to you. Now, you'll notice that littered throughout, as you read through verses 23 to 31, and you read through Abigail's speech, you notice how often she says, "My Lord, my Lord, my Lord." She's very deferential, 14 times to David there. But, of course, this is the intervention that keeps David from proceeding on to wipe out Nabal and all the retainers and male retainers in his household. So it's very important. That's the intervention. And then the last movement is resolution. So have tension and intervention and then resolution, and that's the work of Yahweh in verses 36 to 39. Abigail didn't tell Nabal what she'd done until the next day when he was sober again. And then it says when she told him all that had happened, his heart became like stone. We don't know. Was that a stroke, perhaps? And then 10 days later, it says Yahweh struck Nabal and he died. That was the work of Yahweh. That's the resolution. Yahweh disposes of Nabal. David didn't have to bother with it. Now, as you look at all that, and we've reviewed the story again, well, why should I care? What instruction does this have for me as I may be a believer? today, and I think several matters can be pressed before us. These aren't in some kind of scintillating, alliterated order or anything like that. But number one, I think we can say roadblocks, frustrations, and hindrances may be evidence of God's grace to you. Roadblocks, frustrations, and hindrances may be evidence of God's grace to you. You see that in this passage. In this narrative, God intervenes to restrain David, his servant, from doing evil and to rescue him from his own impulsive stupidity. Now, he intervenes. He does it through Abigail. And you'll notice that that note of restraint comes up several times. Notice verses 26, 33, 34, and 39. 26, for example. Abigail says, Yahweh has held you back from coming with bloodshed. How has he done that? Well, because Abigail met him and brought the goodies to David and to his men. She intervened. And then you notice verse 33, the same note. David here says, blessed be your judgment and blessed be you yourself who have restrained me this day from coming with bloodshed. You did that, Abigail. But then notice in verse 34, he knows who really did it. But as surely as Yahweh, God of Israel, lives, who has held me back from harming you. There's that note of restraint again. And then in verse 39, David says again, blessed be Yahweh who's prosecuted the case of the insults I received from the hands of Nabal and who restrained his servant from evil. There's been restraint. There's been holding back from doing what he had wanted to do. There was a roadblock. There was a hindrance. And it was a saving one. Yahweh sent David a savior in skirts in this case. It was a matter of God's providence preventing his self-chosen folly. And you can understand how Abigail was right. What would have happened if David would have gone ahead and wiped out Nabal and all his men and so on in the household? Why, he would have lost all kinds of support, no doubt, in the tribe of Judah. Others would look at that and they would have become quite anti-David. And not only that, but in verse 31, Abigail seems to indicate, and you would have had to live with your conscience, David, of shedding that blood, and so on. So this was the goodness of God's providence in sending this roadblock, this hindrance, into the works to cut David off. Sometimes in your life as a Christian, just in daily life, sometimes you find these roadblocks or frustrations in the puniest matters, and I may be wrong, but you kind of divine that maybe it's the Lord doing it, puny as it may seem. I remember a time in the fall of 2013, we were living then in Tennessee, and we were coming down to a place called First Presbyterian in Columbia, South Carolina, for about 8 weekends during that fall. And so on. And we would come down on Friday and we would stay and preach on Sunday night and go back on Monday. And we did that for 6 or 8 weekends. Now, one of those times, I had to come down by myself because Barbara had some commitment and she had to have the good car and so on. So I was going to come down one weekend by myself and I would use my pickup and so on. Now, about 10 days or 2 weeks before this time came, I was backing my pickup out of the garage, and I'd noticed a little problem with it, seemed like, before, but it hadn't been acute. All of a sudden, the clutch went out. Standard transmission, no clutch, couldn't. What to do? Those things never happen at a convenient times, and couldn't even drive it into the shop. Had to have it towed, etc. They had to get the parts. It was in there like 4 or 5 days. Finally got it back and so on. Just a whole lot of existential crud that you had to mess with and so on. But when you look back and think about it, that little hindrance was sort of a plus, because the clutch then didn't go out, at a rest area on Interstate 26 when I was trying to get to Columbia in another week. It's a small thing. It's a hindrance. It's a frustration. But sometimes it's a kind of a saving one, even in small things. What mercy sends frustration to our purposes? And what kindness builds hindrances in our path? I told you, I think, before of Stuart Holden. Stuart Holden was sitting in his study. He was an Anglican vicar, English and so on, and he was preparing to go to North America. He was in quite much demand as a speaker at conferences and Christian gatherings, and he was that way in the British Isles, and also had gone some 30 times across the Atlantic and so on to speak and to preach. And he had a commitment, and he had his passage all booked, ready to go, make another trip over to the States or to Canada, whichever it was. But as he sat there in his study looking at his ship passage, he realized he couldn't go. His wife had just been in hospital, and she had to have an operation, and there was no way he could take off across the ocean and leave his wife by herself. And so he canceled that. Did I tell you that that date for that sailing was on April 10th, 1912, and it was booked on a ship called the Titanic? You tend to think that roadblock was indeed a merciful one. It was one of those saving hindrances. And God will tend to do that. But often you can't see it at the time. Sometimes you don't read it that way. Sometimes you may never discover any particular light on it. But sometimes you have to realize that you can't know enough to know whether God is being unkind in these roadblocks. And so we're out of it. We don't have the wisdom. We can't penetrate into things. It's sort of like in 1912, Teddy Roosevelt was involved in an intense political campaign. He, of course, started up kind of a new party and so on. There was a three-way race and all of that. But T.R. was in the thick of a presidential campaign. He was in, I think Chicago or somewhere. But there was a press conference that they were having and so on. And sometime during that press conference or that gathering, T.R. had called a fellow by the name of Clark, a reporter for Chicago newspaper, over and was carrying on a very animated whispered conversation with him. Naturally, this aroused the curiosity of other people who were watching. You know, what's going on here? This must be some major political consideration or question going on. And finally, after it was over, the other reporters gathered around Clark and asked him about it. What was that all about? And he said, well, you see, Teddy happened to see what he thought was a hermit thrush at his home place in Oyster Bay and so on. And he knows I'm an amateur ornithologist as well. And so he was asking me about describing the bird in detail and so on, and asking me if what he had seen at his home place was indeed a hermit thrush. Who would have ever guessed in 1,000 years that that's what that conversation was about on the side of a Chicago, of a press conference? You would never guess that. And so it is sometimes with God's roadblocks and with God's hindrances, we can't penetrate to see the rationale behind them. Sometimes we can, but we can't always. Sometimes it's opaque. But you have to let the knowledge that sometimes these are God's gracious roadblocks. And so you didn't get the position you worked for and trained for. Somebody else got into that slot. and you didn't get accepted into the prestigious grad school program that you salivated for. You had to take number four on your list. But did you ever think that in those situations, God may have been saving you from something you couldn't see? Roadblocks, frustrations, and hindrances may be evidence of God's grace to you. Now, there's a second matter here. It is, God's servants are not always adept at wisdom transfer. We can put wisdom transfer in quotation marks. God's servants are not always adept at wisdom transfer. What do we mean by that? Well, if you look back, you notice the contrast between what happens in chapter 25 and what happened in chapter 24. In chapter 24, like about verses 3 to 7 or so, you remember that's episode where King Saul comes into the cave and David and his men are further back in the cave and he uses the facilities, as it were, and then apparently takes a nap and so on. And David's men want David to wipe Saul out, assassinate him on the spot, grab the king. Kingship and so on, and David won't do it. He says, basically, I can't put forth my hand against Yahweh's anointed. He's off limits. So you see that element of restraint in chapter 24. But you get into chapter 25, and when he gets the insult of Nabal and so on, that he throws up at David's men, there's no restraint. In chapter 24, David won't take vengeance for himself. He holds himself back out of principle. But in chapter 25, he's ready to take his vengeance. It made his blood boil, obviously. But Nabal didn't have to give David's men any goodies. And yes, he did slander and badmouth him and trash talk him and so on. Sure, it would make you mad. But somehow David didn't see that the kind of response he had toward Saul in chapter 24, toward a murderous king, ought to carry over into another situation toward an obnoxious herdsman. You change the circumstances, you change the characters a little bit. The principles really aren't the same, but there's no wisdom transfer that causes him to say, I held back in relation to Saul in chapter 24, and he will again in chapter 26. But with chapter 25, there's something about the Nabal episode that sets him off, and he's ready to spill blood. Because, well, it just ticked him off. And he was ready to take his own vengeance. There wasn't that wisdom transfer. Now, that's easy for us to fail in. But we need to see that we ought to be able to do it. There was a situation or an incident recalled by Bruce Catton in one of his books on the war between the states took place at Gettysburg in 1863, and there was a Union artillery contingent that was under the command of a Lieutenant James Stewart, and they were firing into the Confederate lines. And Lieutenant Stewart was on his horse amid the artillery guns and so on, facing toward the enemy. Now, Catton says that was partly because he was a brave man himself, and it was also partly because his horse was a veteran with certain fixed ideas about battle. You see, in some previous action, there was a shell fragment that had cut off most of the horse's tail. And ever since then, the horse steadfastly refused to expose his rear end to the foe whenever the shooting started. there was wisdom transfer. That's not going to happen again. But sometimes we can be in a situation like David was in chapter 24, and you might say, by God's grace, perform beautifully. We get into another one with a little bit different trappings, and we don't see that the same principles need to apply. There's not that transfer. So what do we do? Well, I think we have to get back, you might say, and punt. And we go back to James chapter 1, don't we? Shouldn't it lead us there? You remember when James says, if any of you lack wisdom, James 1:5. Now, what's he mean there? Well, if you look at the context, chapter 1, verses 2 to 4, James is talking about considering all joy when you fall into multicolored trials, etc. And so in James 1, 2 to 4, he's talking about how we manage through trials and troubles. And then he says in chapter 1, verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, I think it's connected to what went before. What's James saying? If any of you lack wisdom about how to negotiate and walk through these trials, if you lack the wisdom, let him ask the giving God, literally, who gives to all generously and without criticizing. In other words, what James is saying, if you find yourself deficient and defective and you don't think you can know how to muddle through all this stuff, then beg the giving God to give you wisdom in it. And I think that's where this point in 1 Samuel 25 leads us. God's servants are not always adept at wisdom transfer, but we can ask the Lord for that kind of wisdom in the midst and in the thick of it. Now, there's a third matter here. How crucial God's anonymous servants can be. Verses 14 to 17 in particular. How crucial God's anonymous servants can be. Now, Abigail gets all the kudos, basically, humanly speaking. And I suppose you could say, rightly so, she did not only a gracious but a gutsy thing in what she did in intercepting David and begging him and speaking to him and instructing him and admonishing him and so on to prevent unnecessary bloodshed. But Abigail's initiative would have never taken place if it hadn't been for an unnamed servant in verses 14 to 17 telling her about the danger. Everything in the story hinges on that. I mean, I don't want to make too much of it, but really, if that young servant hadn't have told Abigail the danger they were in and what had happened and how Nabal had ripped on David and so on, she would have never gone about her intervention. It all rests on this unnamed young man in verses 14 to 17 who told her and then said, and Abigail, you can be sure that disaster is determined on us. You know what you need to do. So, everything hangs on that. You ever notice how often something hangs on anonymous people? Very important thing. Well, it depends, I suppose, in some cases on your political views, but there was a time when former President Ronald Reagan, he was still in the movie industry. This was sometime between 1947 and 1950. And he contracted viral pneumonia. And he was in the hospital. His temperature spiked. He was delirious. He was apparently having hallucinations. He really came very close to dying. And one night, when he was having apparently some hallucinations and so on, he was so exhausted by the effort to breathe that it's as if some part of his brain told him it would be better not to. And so he told a nurse that he was too tired to breathe anymore. Well, she stayed with him. She took his hand and she coaxed him. Take a breath, she'd say. Now let it out. Good. Now breathe in again. Okay, now out. She saved his life. Reagan said she was so nice and persistent that he felt he had to do what she wanted. But who was she? Don't know. But at least for Reagan, it meant a good deal. Anonymous folks. And you find this in the scripture, don't you? You remember reading in 2 Kings chapter 5 about Naaman's wife? Mrs. Naaman got a little Israelite girl that was captured on a raid the Syrians had made on Israel. Who knows how old she was? I don't know, 8 or 9, I'm not sure. Must have been traumatic being carried off in a military raid and taken to a land that wasn't her own and separated from her parents probably. But anyway, she was doing housework for Captain Naaman's wife. And she happened to say, since Naaman had leprosy, happened to say one day while she was dusting the end tables or something like that, "Oh, that my master were with the prophet that is in Samaria. He could heal him of his leprosy." And one thing led to another, and Naaman went to Samaria, and he went to Israel, and he connected with Elisha the prophet, and through Elisha, Yahweh healed him of his leprosy, etc., 2 Kings 5. But it all started because a little girl said something to Mrs. Naaman while she was cleaning the house. We don't know her name, but everything in 2 Kings 5 would not have happened if it wasn't for that little girl. Or you go to Acts chapter 23 and verses 16 and following, and Paul was being held in custody in Jerusalem and so on. And there were some Jews that wanted to assassinate him, and so they kind of made a little conspiracy with the chief priests and the elders, and they said, "Now, what we want you to do," I think there were about 40 of them, they said, "We've taken an oath that we're not going to eat until we assassinate Paul. What we want you fellows to do is to connect with the Roman Tribune and say that you want to have another hearing so that you can question Paul a little more closely in this whole thing. And when they try to bring him down to where the hearing will take place, we'll attack and we'll eliminate Paul." That just so happened that Paul's sister's son overheard them conspiring. He must have been a little fellow that couldn't be very big, because when he came and told Paul, Paul told them to take him to the Tribune. And when they came to the Tribune took him by the hand and led him off so they could talk privately. So he was probably a rather small, probably wasn't very old, but he overheard the conspiracy going. Everything in the saving of Paul's life there rested on his nephew having overheard that. We don't know his name, of course. Typical. And so here in 1 Samuel 25, everything rests on this young servant spelling out the danger to Nabal's wife. Now, what response do we make to that? Well, you don't get sentimental about little maids and so on. But if you make the right response, you ought to adore the God who in his kindness and wisdom leaves no detail untended, who has anonymous servants and little maids and snooping nephews precisely where they need to be. And so we come out at the end of 1 Samuel 25, where we usually do, having to say, "There is no God like you who is worthy of all praise." Let us pray. How gracious you are, our God, in your hindrances that you throw across our path. How patient you are in teaching us wisdom. how careful you are in your providence. You are all that God should be to us. And so once more, we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.